or Radio Catskill. From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition, and I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. We have a lot of news tonight. Coming up, an update on the ongoing situation with Pennsylvania's disappearing pharmacies. Ed Mahon of Spotlight PA is on the case, and he has a lot more detailed info than when I spoke to him just a couple weeks ago. We would talk to him later on in the program. Also tonight, the Village of Liberty has banned sleeping in public areas as it attempts to deal with homelessness. We have Kimberly Izar's report coming up in just a few minutes. We're going to start right now with news from Albany, where Governor Kathy Hochul says she told President Trump that New York does not need him to send National Guard troops. WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports.
The Democratic governor says she spoke with Trump a few days ago and told him crime in New York City is down.
I just said, I'll tell you what, Mr. President, if I think I need help from the National Guard beyond what I'm already doing, I know where to find you.
Trump says the National Guard has reduced crime in Washington, D.C. during a recent deployment. The president says he hopes Hochul changes her mind and accepts his offer to send troops.
I hope that New York, I hope that California, I hope they call me and they say, I'd love to have you come in and help us out.
Hochul sent National Guard troops into subways on her own last year to calm fears over crime. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
Thank you, Jimmy. On Monday's local edition, I spoke with Sam Mellons of New York Focus about his article, Lawmakers Get Few Answers on Home Care Chaos, which is up at nysfocus.com. And it was mainly about the Consumer Directed Personal Assistance Program, or CDPAP, hearing that was held last week, chaired by upstate New York Senator James Skoufis. He chairs a committee on investigations and government operations. Well, they were trying to get answers about New York's home care program, the company that runs it, and the company that they contract to handle health insurance for their employees. Skoufis was quoted in that New York Focus article as saying 80% of what they heard at the hearing was a waste of time, even though State Health Commissioner James V. McDonald was also there to answer questions. Well, Skoufis was on public radio's The Capitol Press Room today and gave more details about lawmakers' frustrations over the lack of answers from the Hochul administration, not just at last week's CDPAP hearing, but previous legislative inquiries as well. Here's Capitol Press Room's David Lombardo.
There was the promise from both the Department of Health and PPL to follow up in the wake of this hearing. What does that look like potentially, and what are your plans for then making some of that information public?
Yeah, so one of my frustrations from budget hearings, so for your listeners, at the start of every year, we have a lot of commissioners who come to the legislature and other stakeholders and provide testimony and answer questions, as it pertains to the budget proposals in a given year. And it has always been remarkable to me how many times a commissioner, a superintendent at an agency, does not know the answer, does not offer an answer to a question, and just punts it off with a, I'll have to circle back with you, or I'll have to follow up with you. And 9 times out of 10, and I'm probably being generous with that estimate, 9 times out of 10, they do not circle back. They do not follow up. And that, by the way, is something unto itself that needs to be addressed. It's part of this disrespect over the course of many years, many administrations that has accumulated towards the legislature from the executive branch. But I can tell you that there is insistence that there will be follow-up. And look, we have tools at our disposal if there is not appropriate and satisfactory follow-up. And as far as, you know, public, private interviews, document requests, another hearing. There are a lot of potential next steps. It'd be premature for me to hypothesize what exactly we're going to do yet, because I have not had that conversation with Senator Rivera, committee members, and leadership, but there will be next steps.
David Lombardo of Capitol Press Room speaking with State Senator James Skoufis this week. More of that interview is up at capitalpressroom.org. And now some water news. In the most recent fiscal year, New York made more investments in water infrastructure than in any prior year. WAMC's Samantha Simmons has details.
Announcing the record spending Wednesday at Albany's Corning Preserve, President and CEO of New York's Environmental Facilities Corporation, Maureen Coleman, says nearly 330 projects were executed with financial assistance in the last fiscal year, a 55% increase year to year.
In state fiscal year 2025, EFC didn't just invest $3.4 billion in infrastructure. We invested in public health, in natural habitats, in resilience, and in the future of New York. And clean water for every New Yorker is a goal we will meet.
The projects are meant to improve water quality, create jobs, and protect public health. Largely paid through the State Revolving Fund, which is the primary financial mechanism meant to advance clean water efforts and other state investments, Coleman says the corporation can't lean on federal investments to support infrastructure improvements under the Trump administration. Congressman Paul Tonko of New York's 20th District says he will continue his fight in Washington, D.C. to ensure New Yorkers have clean drinking water, something that he said could be under threat without federal support for water infrastructure.
I will continue. I commit to continue to fight for every SRF dollar possible in the appropriations process by sharing stories, the most powerful tool we have for advocacy, stories of how these dollars are being spent effectively to protect and improve the lives of New Yorkers across the state.
The funding also supports resiliency efforts, such as infrastructure to support flood-prone areas. Adrienne Esposito is the executive director of the Nature Conservancy in New York. She says New York is doing its part to make its coastlines more resilient.
This program benefits everybody. It benefits our health. It benefits our economy. It benefits our sustainability and our livability, particularly in areas like Long Island, where I'm from, which is extremely vulnerable to these types of challenges.
Commissioner of Health James McDonald says, quote, environmental health is not sexy, unquote. He says most water looks good, but there could be hidden contaminants that can be extremely harmful, making water treatment critical.
If this cup of water was contaminated with lead, it would look and taste like a cup of water. If it was contaminated with PFAS or other forever chemicals, it would look and taste like a cup of water.
A detailed list of projects can be found on the Environmental Facility Corporation's website. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Samantha Simmons.
And thank you to the New York Public News Network for these reports. And now we move on to our feature local news story tonight. Last week, the Village Board of Liberty approved a local law on August 21st to prohibit camping or sleeping in village parks, sidewalks, streets, and other public areas. It's part of the village's efforts to deal with homelessness. Radio Catskills Kimberly Izar reports.
Inside the Liberty Municipal Building on Liberty's Main Street, a local public hearing is packed. More than 40 people fill each seat in the room, with more folks standing, spilling onto the edges of the chamber. The public hearing is for a local law to prohibit sleeping or camping in the Village of Liberty's public areas.
We're not trying to punish homeless people, but we are concerned about their safety and the safety of the people who, you know, who choose to walk on the sidewalk.
That's Village of Liberty Mayor Joan Stoddard. Last Thursday, the village board approved a local law that bans camping or sleeping in village parks, public sidewalks, streets, alleyways, or other public areas. Local residents had mixed reactions. Joanne Omar was one attendee who urged the mayor to reconsider.
Studies have proven when you start to relocate people who, for different reasons, are afraid of services or we may not have the services, what happens is they relocate. Due to the additional stressors, then there may be increased problems for them. They may resort to other things. So what I'm asking is, shouldn't you be more concerned about services other than just clearing them out?
Stoddard says the lack of services is not the village's problem.
And that's something that unfortunately the county needs to address, the state needs to address, but it's not something that the village has any control over.
The new law comes just 1 month after President Trump signed an executive order that makes it easier for states and cities to remove outdoor encampments. But Mayor Stoddard says the village has deliberated on the law for months, even before the executive order was announced. A study from the Journal of the American Medical Association shows that encampment sweeps and forcibly relocating homeless people could lead to significant jumps in overdose deaths, hospitalizations, and mortality. Sullivan County resident Jen Duncan is currently homeless. She says the local law directly puts her life at risk.
I first went homeless back in 2009. And I haven't got the help from DSS that I'm supposed to have over and over and over. And there have been some formal complaints that have gone far, and I believe they're not complete yet. But I have not, I'm allowed to say this about my case, I have not received services from DSS.
The local law outlines that people sleeping or setting up public encampments in the Village of Liberty creates a, quote, public health and safety hazard, end quote. Liberty defines a campsite as setting up chairs or blankets for the purpose of sitting or laying on it. Several community members spoke in favor of the law, saying it's necessary to keep residents safe.
What about the older people and people who are afraid to come into the building? And what about the senior citizens that don't go into the senior citizens? They are being penalized. They are being penalized too. So there's two sides of this coin.
One attendee, Alan Goodman, says he's in support of the local law to maintain Liberty's appearance. He wants to see more police monitoring the streets.
This is not helpful for attracting people and wanting them to come into town, get out of their car, go into a merchant, patronize a bank, have more reasons to come into the town.
The village's decision to ban public sleeping or camping comes when Sullivan County legislators have been grappling with where to build the county's first gateway housing shelter. After the legislature failed to approve a site location in April, legislators have gone back to the drawing board to find a new location. Sullivan County District 5 legislator Kat Scott, who attended the public hearing in Liberty, says the clock is ticking to build the Gateway Housing Center, since much of the project's funding depends on state grant funding.
Now, with the cuts that are coming down from the federal government, the state is probably not going to be so easy with grant money next year. So I'm erring on the side of caution and saying that we have to do this now.
District 6 legislator Louis Alvarez, who represents Liberty, says he needs the public to come out to county meetings and push legislators to address the county's growing homelessness crisis. To do that, he'll need the Village of Liberty's support.
What we need is for the village to really earmark, this is what we're supporting. Come and support us. We need the town to come and support us so they stop this part and we can move forward, because she wants it, I want it. John Little has done hours and hours and hours of work in putting this together, but now we're getting people in behind our back saying, we don't want it here. We don't want it in Liberty. No, we don't want it here. Where are we going to put it?
The meeting ended on a tense note. The village board tried to close the hearing while Jen Duncan continued to speak about how she, as a homeless person herself, would be most impacted by the law.
Ma'am,
I need this to be known publicly because there's people on the streets.
Enough. You've made your point.
You had your time.
You had your time. We're going to close the book. You're relaxed here. I'll entertain a motion to close the public hearing.
I'm harmed and injured. I'm the one whose life is at risk the most here.
All in favor?
The government pays too.
Okay.
The Village of Liberty filed the local ordinance with New York State on Monday, and the law is now in effect immediately. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Well, it's been about 2 weeks since I last spoke with Ed Mahan, investigative reporter for Spotlight PA, about the loss of pharmacies in Pennsylvania and the impact that's having on people's lives. Well, since then, he's done even more investigating, and he's gotten a lot more details about the scope and the scale of this situation. And the biggest thing that I learned in talking to him earlier this afternoon is that this is still happening. Here's Ed Mahan.
We got the licensing data from the Department of State because pharmacies are licensed through the Board of Pharmacy, and you know that's connected to the Department of State in Pennsylvania. And so overall, more than 800 licensed pharmacies have closed since January 2020, so over the past 5 years or so. And while some new ones have opened during that time period, it wasn't enough to make up the difference. And so we just, you know, one of the first things we did was sort of just break down in raw numbers how many pharmacies closed. And you had Philadelphia during that period, obviously the biggest county by population in the state. They had about 180 pharmacies closed. Allegheny had 80 pharmacies closed. And, you know, in some of the northeastern Pennsylvania, you had Wayne County had 3 pharmacies closed, Lackawanna 21, Bradford 3. I can give others too if you're interested. But there was just, you know, sort of nearly every county in the state had at least one pharmacy closed. Some state lawmakers have cited these closures as they're pushing for legislation that would address, you know, that would aim to address some of the payments that pharmacies receive for their work.
And I will encourage the listener to actually, you know, put this article before them. It's up at spotlightpa.org. The big impact of Pennsylvania pharmacy closures explained in 3 maps. So you have these interactive maps where you can actually easily mouse over each county in this instance and see how many pharmacies are closed. I like that the scale goes all the way up to 182 because that's the most in, obviously, in Philadelphia County, as you said, which is where the most population is. And you just mentioned Wayne with 3 pharmacies that have closed. And also in our listening areas, Pike County only has 1 pharmacy closed. Well, they're all the way on the small end of the scale. But of course, these are very sparsely populated areas. So, you know, losing 3 pharmacies in a rural county like Wayne County, that's pretty serious for folks.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the other maps we did, we wanted to provide some greater context. So based on the state licensing data, the data that the state has was showing 1 pharmacy for every 10,000 people in Pike County. So that was on the lower end statewide. So they were already at a lower end. So that might be why they had fewer closed. And yet Wayne County, they had about 2 pharmacies for every 10,000 people. And so 1 or 2 pharmacies for every 10,000 people was sort of the typical range. We saw some were higher than that.
Yeah.
But, you know, that gives some context for some of these areas that have fewer closures. They might be ones that didn't have that many pharmacies to begin with relative to their population.
Yeah, as there's much less color disparity in this map that measures how many pharmacies per 10,000 people. And the median would be about 3, but it seems like most counties have, you know, 2 or 2.5 pharmacies on average.
For every 10,000 people, that's it. Yes.
Yeah.
So like most counties, you know, like for instance, like York County, we have, that's where I live, we have 72 pharmacies, licensed pharmacies. And so that breaks down to about 1.5 for every 10,000 people. And I was also, yeah, I was kind of surprised when I initially looked at the data on that, because it was pretty similar across the state. There was like, Montour was listed as an outlier, but overall it was pretty consistent. You know, one of the issues is there's some counties there are a couple of different issues. In rural counties, it's difficult because they're serving much bigger geographic areas. So, you know, one of the measures people often use is, you know, how many people have to travel more than 5 miles for a pharmacy. And that can affect access to care.
Then you also note that some areas have been hit particularly hard. What did you look at there and what did you find?
So, yeah, we looked at zip code data. So you could zoom in. And that was very interesting, too, because, you know, especially in a place like Philadelphia, you know, looking at the entire city, the entire county for our purposes, might not tell you the people as much about people's day-to-day experiences. So you can see some zip codes in Philadelphia lost a lot of pharmacies in recent year. I think some were up to like 10 or so. And there were some other zip codes across the state where it was, you know, you go from 0 to about 10 pharmacies in one zip code. And zip codes are, you know, smaller geographic areas. And, you know, one of the things we heard is that where you often see the biggest impact is usually in rural locations and some underserved areas. For instance, the director of York City's Bureau of Health, they told me that the closure of the downtown Rite Aid is a huge loss for the community because so many people walk to that Rite Aid for their medications, but also just for their everyday staples, you know, whether it's over-the-counter medications, whether it's cleaning supplies, whether it's some groceries. People relied on that downtown store. And then you also have these rural areas where people have to drive farther to get to their pharmacy. And there was also an analysis from the Center for Rural Pennsylvania, and they looked at the potential impact of the Rite Aid closures. And they found that 9 rural Pennsylvania counties would see the biggest percentage change in total pharmacies if all of the Rite Aid locations were to close without any replacements for any of them. So that takeaway from that analysis is that these Rite Aid closures have a potentially very big impact on some of these rural areas. And these closures, the report says, you know, may further widen health disparities and reduce access to essential care for many locations. So that, you know, that's sort of the big takeaway is one, you know, looking at the impact in rural areas where it's hard to drive, whenever you have to drive further, and then some urban areas where people are just relying on being able to walk too. You know, I think that's a big question in terms of the impact of these ongoing closures. And then when you get to, you were talking to a number of patients about the issue, and you know, some of them don't particularly like mail order as a substitute. Some of them say they can't get that, all the medications they need through mail order. And they also talk about how when they do mail order, they don't get to have the same interactions with the local pharmacists that they've come to rely on. So there are, and then the other big thing is once your pharmacy, if your pharmacy closes, you know, it's one thing to have less coffee in the afternoon, but some people might just slip through the cracks and not bother getting their prescription refilled right away. And that can worsen health conditions, some chronic conditions as well. So there's a lot of, you know, significant health issues involved in this.
It's tough to get lower income folks access to health care in the first place, to get out of their day-to-day routine and actually stay on top of their own health care because they have so many other things that they're dealing with. You don't need another barrier for that category of folks.
Yeah, and that was one of the issues that an official with Family First Health, she had talked to me about back in July, and they were planning on opening a pharmacy in York to sort of help address part of the gaps that were going to exist in the community. And they talked about how their experience with past pharmacy closures is that when you have them, people slip through the cracks, and that creates real problems.
So you're reporting that you know, Rite Aid and the loss of Rite Aid has had a big impact here, but you're also comparing it to other chains. So what did you in places that have pharmacies in chains of pharmacies? So what did you find out about any other details about the role of Rite Aid in all this? And then what did you hear from those other chains?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. So one of the things we were just curious is, like, you know, we knew there are hundreds of Rite Aid, and we're just sort of curious, hundreds of Rite Aids in Pennsylvania. We're sort of curious at just quantifying how big of an impact this would have. And I think there were, you know, so that more than 280 Rite Aid pharmacies closed in Pennsylvania in recent years, but it was still a leading pharmacy chain in the state. And so that data showed that it had about 230 active pharmacy licenses as of early July 2025. And, you know, I acknowledge that, and we've acknowledged in the chart that Rite Aid has continued to close since then, but that's when our data was. But with that about 230, it was, you know, ranking second among the big chains that we saw. CVS has about 455, 58 or so, depending on what you count, pharmacies in the state. And the second one is Rite Aid. And then after that, you get Walmart with about 130, Giant, Martin's, they have about 115, and then some other ones. You know, Walgreens, for instance, has 96. But, you know, if you just think about the fact that Rite Aid had 280 closed and they still had 230 open, you know, they were a huge place that people relied on in Pennsylvania. And so that this gives some greater context for where, you know, where, how the magnitude of the impact of losing them is.
I'm sorry, did I lose you?
No, I'm here. They get some sense of the magnitude of the impact.
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah.
So, and I'll just note, too, that you mentioned Weiss is in that list. And I know that there's a Weiss in Honesdale in Wayne County. And they basically, you reached out to them to like confirm your numbers. So, like, they said, like, yeah, your info is right on this. But I just want to pick one thing that, I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
Oh, yeah. And so Weiss was one of the other ones we looked at, 91, and Giant Eagle was 101. I'm not sure everybody's pharmacy, grocery store chains that they rely on. But yeah, so we have a list. I think we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 7 of the big chains And other things I'm curious about looking into is sort of just how some medical organizations, you know, some health systems, whether they've significantly expanded their imprint of their footprint of pharmacies in recent years. But, you know, we reached out to every one of these pharmacies we named because we were basing it off the names. You know, we didn't have, the data didn't show the actual owner. It had names. So we reached out to all of them to verify our understanding. And Giant Eagle said it had increased its numbers a little bit since the July data. And some other places provided some helpful context information. But we want to take the steps to make sure our information is accurate, fair, and if there are any objections to what our findings are, we want to know ahead of time and give everybody that chance.
Right. And as you're saying, the numbers that you're looking through data that's as of early July. But like on that note, I want to trying to make sure those numbers are accurate. You're confirming with the companies. But I just want to pick one thing that you said in all of that is I think you said that more Rite Aids have even closed since early July. You're talking about a shift in numbers just in the last 6 weeks. Is that correct?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the data we got was the state licensing data as of early July. You know, we keep seeing, you know, more Rite Aids close, and Rite Aid has announced that they are planning to sell off substantially all of their assets as part of bankruptcy proceedings, and it, you know, has continued to close stores. So I think the general sense is that, you know, Rite Aids are not going to be, there's not going to be any Rite Aids after once these are all finished up. And so I'm really curious to go back to this data in a few months or so when the field has settled a little bit and we've seen if anybody has gone in to fill the void left by Rite Aid or not. So I'm really curious in the next, you know, month or two, next couple months to like go back and look at this data and see what the status is across the state in terms of pharmacies.
But that just really underscores for the listener the fact that this story is very much in progress. The data, the information on the ground is shifting week to week on this, and that's why you're taking this close of a look at it.
Yes, 100%. Yeah, we're really, it's changing that. Yeah, it's changing it week to week, as you said.
So you're just saying some of what you're going to be looking for, in the months ahead. So I think we'll check in with you again about that. But right now at this stage of the story, is there anything else that you want to let folks know about just what this all means now that you've gotten all this research?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really shows the breadth of the problem across the state, and it helps give you some context for why so many lawmakers are trying to take action because, you know, these pharmacies, they're in their communities. And so when they leave, that can have a real impact on residents of their communities, and these lawmakers, they don't want to see that happen. And it'll be curious to see how some legislation is implemented, whether it's implemented up to in a way that lawmakers are satisfied with, and if there are further steps they take, you know, to try and address these closures.
Yeah, and so we just identified that this is an active in progress problem that you are reporting on, and it's changing from week to week, let alone month to month, and that lawmakers are concerned about it. But since we last talked a few weeks ago, how fast are things changing on the lawmaking front? I mean, legislature is not in session right now. So are there any developments on the lawmaking end of this?
I would say I'm not aware of any significant developments on the lawmakers end of it. We're looking into we're doing some reporting. I'll tell everybody that now we're doing some reporting about some of the concerns they have raised, and readers, listeners can expect some of that. But I think that with all the state budget negotiations, I think that, and with, you know, summer recess in general, I think that is taking up a lot of oxygen in Harrisburg right now. But I'd be curious to see if new legislation is introduced in the fall that would address some of these issues and how that might progress.
We've been talking with Ed Mahon, who is an investigative reporter with Spotlight PA and focuses on departments of drug and alcohol programs, human services, and addiction treatment in the opioid epidemic in Pennsylvania. He is on the trail of the disappearing pharmacies in Pennsylvania. These stories are up now at spotlightpa.org. Ed, thank you again for this reporting. I look forward to your next update on this story.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Well, that's it for the local edition tonight. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. We'll be back again tomorrow. We'll talk to Philip Pantuso of Times Union to get the latest news. For now, stay with us for more news coming up from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.